Now a small pop quiz. Only one question. Name a famous record label known for its jazz recordings. If the words Blue Note came to mind, it's no surprise. That name has become synonymous with jazz. Although the label has had both fiscal and musical ups and downs, it's been in operation for over six decades. An amazing roster of artists fills the Blue Note catalog. Miles Davis, Art Blakey, Bud Powell, Herbie Hancock. More recently, Greg Osby, Stanley Jordan, and superstar singer Nora Jones. Richard Cook, editor of Jazz Review, is the author of Blue Note Records, a biography published by Justin Charles and Company. The story of the venerable label begins in 1939, when it was established by two German immigrants, Francis Wolff and Alfred Lion.
Alfred was a man who fell in love with jazz when he first heard it, when he went out to what he thought was going to be a day's skating, and the skating had been cancelled, and he heard an American band playing there in his native town. And when he started coming to America, he became a fully-fledged jazz fan, and he wanted to do something about documenting it.
Sidney Bechet was an early star at the label Ike Quebec. He later became an A&R. Man.
Yes, Quebec was very important because he really changed the ball game. He brought to their attention bebop music. By the time they did start recording it, the bebop movement was well underway, and people like Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie were very well known. But the one man who had not yet started making records, but who was nevertheless really one of the prime forces behind bebop, was Thelonious Monk.
Criss Cross is a number that you highlight. This is one that Monk made with Milt Jackson.
I just think it's an almost perfect record. There's nothing about it which is out of place. It's almost as if the whole thing was written out from start to finish, and yet it is basically a piece of improvised music.
Sound soon became synonymous with an engineer named Rudy Van Gelder. How did he become part of the Blue Note family?
Well, Alfred had been pretty content doing the records that he had been in, a couple of places actually in New York, but someone alerted him to Rudy Van Gelder, who was really an inspired amateur at this point, but someone who was very obsessed with getting a good sound, and he'd actually set up a studio in his parents' front room.
This is in Hackensack, New Jersey.
That's right.
And he was an optometrist as well.
Yes, right? That was his day job, as it were. So Alfred went there and looked at the setup and said, yeah, this feels like a place where we could do some records. And I guess that Rudy really was someone, again, he was on the Blue Note wavelength. He felt the music was important. He felt the musicians had to be respected. And he was a very meticulous man. He continues to be to this day. And there's just something about Blue Note's mixes, about the way Van Gelder managed to balance the loud instruments and soft instruments in such a way that for the first time, in many cases, you're hearing the bass on jazz records, and you're hearing the different levels of drum work between the different drums and the cymbals. And for their time, they are remarkable sonic documents.
Gave its artists rehearsal time. I mean, 2 days of rehearsal. Wasn't there a saying, you have it, you know, comparing Blue Note to the rival label Prestige, the difference between them was 2 days of rehearsal?
That's right. Interestingly enough, it was actually the boss of Prestige who said that.
Really? But rehearsal obviously contributes to the quality.
Absolutely so. And it was important to Alfred in particular, I think, because the takes that he liked tended to be ones where the head, the theme statement, was at its crispest. He almost didn't care if another performance had better solos, if the theme statement was a bit raggedy. If he got an absolutely perfect statement, then a couple of solos, and then another perfect statement to end the track, that's what he liked best.
Horace Silver, the artist that exemplifies Blue Note's magic.
He's the quintessential Blue Note artist, for a number of reasons, really. He was with the label longer than anyone else. He was with the label continuously for a period of something like 25 years, and the Horace Silver group sound is the sound of hard bop, the kind of funky, upbeat, finger-snapping sound, but with always the backbone of the blues in there, and bebop. It was poppy and it was upbeat, but it was very deep and profound at the same time, and I think that the kind of grooving music that he exemplified, I think Alfred loved that music more than any other.
Before Alfred Lion sold Blue Note in 1966, there was a recording session in 1964, and it was Lee Morgan's The Sidewinder, and this was the big hit. But this was the beginning of the end for the original Blue Note.
Well, it was, as you say, only 2 years later, Alfred actually sold the label, which seems an extraordinary thing to do until you consider the situation. They'd been doing this label now for 25 years, almost all the way through that time. It really hadn't been much other than two German guys, a little office in New York, and a lot of recording sessions. And all of a sudden, one of those sessions produced one track, this grooving, bluesy piece called The Sidewinder, which was a tremendous hit. It actually drove the album into the best-selling charts, which was an unprecedented situation for Blue Note. And like so many small businesses, all of a sudden they were obliged to suddenly try and grow or sustain that impetus very quickly. And the strain of it was enormous. Instead of distributors saying, well, let's have another 10 copies of this or 20 copies of that, they were saying, let's have another 500 copies of this. And Alfred began to say to his musicians, look, let's have a track like The Sidewinder on your next record. Mm. It actually perhaps took the fun out of it as far as Alfred and Frank were concerned.
After Alfred Lion sold the label to Liberty in 1966, he stayed on a little bit, but he couldn't stand it, so he retired. And Frank Wolf died in 1971. The decade of the 70s was not at all good for Blue Note. Even the music, you write, Muzak-based candy floss, I think, is your term.
Okay, it's not all bad.
No.
Let me hasten to...
But it is...
Because there are many who would disagree with my judgment on that, I have to say. I just feel that it was such a difficult time for jazz as a whole in the 1970s. Suddenly, jazz found itself almost without an audience. Rock had so completely taken over the popular music market. The magic touch that Alfred seemed to have seemed to leave when he left the label. And although Frank did his best up to when he died, after that, really, the label had nowhere to go.
like a phoenix rising from the ashes, however, in the 80s. The Blue Note sensibility and rebirth began. Bruce Lundvall was someone who knew what Blue Note was all about. 1985, he's heading up the company and he decides to do a reunion concert.
A great thing to do. He felt that they had to have Alfred there. Alfred was in poor health, he was living in retirement, and one day Bruce was sitting in his office and the phone goes and a voice says, "Bruce, this is Al. The concert is a great idea. These are the people you've got to have. Start taking these down." And he starts going through all the names of pretty much everyone who was still alive and who'd made records for Blue Note. So, no, he was absolutely delighted about it. He felt that the new wave, the revival of Blue Note was a terrific thing. Although, sadly, he passed away before he could see that many releases coming out. He did think that of the ones that he did hear, records like Joe Henderson's State of the Tenor and the Stanley Jordan records, Alfred felt that this is exactly the kind of record that the modern Blue Note should be doing.
Was the modern Blue Note's appeal its crossover recordings? Bands like Us Three, Modesky Martin Wood, Cassandra Wilson, or perhaps could it attribute its success to the fact that it allowed new musicians to sample some of the old stuff?
Well, I think the crossover records are very important for any jazz label today because they simply pay for the other records in the same way that Alfred needed his records by people like Jimmy Smith and the Three Sounds to pay for the more far-out stuff, which he felt were important but didn't have the kind of same sales potential. In the same way today, records like Us Three, the Cassandra Wilson records, these have been successful far, far beyond the core jazz audience. We're seeing that right up to 2003 with Miss Nora Jones and her absolutely incredible success.
I waited till I saw the sun. I don't know why I didn't come.
The difficulty is when you have those sorts of successes, there's pressure from outside the immediate ranks of the label to simply repeat that. And I think the marvellous thing about Bruce Lundvall's stewardship of the label has been that he's resisted that kind of pressure. He's able to say, OK, we're not going to do 10 other Nora Jones signings. We've got Nora Jones. And he only needs one act like that on the label to pay for a lot of records by the likes of Jason Moran, the Vibes player, Stefan Harris, Greg Osby, who are not big-selling artists by any means, but the feeling at Blue Note is that they are important artists whose music needs to be documented, and in that sense, it is extraordinarily close to the Alfred Lion era. I'm tremendously encouraged by the fact that for every Nora Jones record, you can look past that and find many, many other examples in the current Blue Note roster of hardcore great jazz.
Richard Cook is the author of Blue Note Records, a biography published by Justin Charles and Company, and he joined us from our London bureau. Thanks very much, Richard.
Thank you.
For more on Blue Note, including historic photos, sound samples, and an extended interview with Richard Cook, visit our website at npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.